You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Amjad.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you doing?
I can't complain. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on streaming video and audio podcast. You are Amjad Atala, currently the chief executive of Vortex International. Is that it? A consulting entity in Washington. But at least as relevant to what we're going to talk about is that you were, I guess for a time, about what, 15 years ago, you were an advisor to Palestinian negotiators. Is that right?
From 2000 to 2003, I was a legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team. And I continued working on the issue for several years after that. But There was a time before the lovey-dovey moment when the Palestinians and the Israelis were having numerous negotiations on things like borders in Jerusalem, etc. I was involved during the time when the Israelis were deconstructing the Palestinian government in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and keeping Arafat under confinement in the Mukataa. And so our work was a little bit more immediate and conflict, instead of, long-term conflict resolution, it was really designed around a lot of the ceasefire attempts and ending the violence right then and there.
Right. Okay. Because, the Second Intifada was a messy time. Now since then, and I should say, we're going to talk about Jerusalem in particular, the Trump decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the implications of that, what is the path forward for Palestinians, for peace, for the whole region in a sense. I should add that since you did that, you were editor-in-chief of Al Jazeera America for a time until the plug on that was pulled by its backers and it ceased to exist, which made it hard to continue to be editor-in-chief of it. And before that, you were with Al Jazeera in another capacity, and and you were at New America Foundation for a while in Washington and so on.
Yes.
So why don't we start by providing a little background on Jerusalem? I think people who haven't been there, even if they followed a lot of the coverage of this Trump thing, I think may not appreciate how clear a division there is in Jerusalem between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. I mean, it's common to say that the status of the city is contested and we're going to leave that, but there is a line that has significance in international law and in the eyes of the international community between West Jerusalem and East Jerusalem, right?
Well, actually, it's Jerusalem itself. When the United Nations decided to partition Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state, they actually left Jerusalem out of it. Jerusalem was supposed to be a corpus separatum. It was supposed to be an international city that was open to everybody and that would be administered internationally. So when the Israelis or when the Jewish militias
Can I interrupt you? And since you're thinking that, maybe we should start at the very beginning and say that the original parcel of land established as Israel, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because it gets hazy if you go back before 1967 for me, but that did not include Jerusalem at all. Is that right?
Right. The partition plan didn't include Jerusalem for either the state that was supposed to be Palestine or the state that was supposed to be Israel.
So that's back in the late 1940s, and then conflict ensues. The two sides have different stories about who was more responsible, but in the course of the conflict, the Jewish founders of Israel expanded their territory.
Right. Right. They took over more than the part that was given to them in the UN partition plan. They ended up taking 78% of historic Palestine instead of the roughly 51-49% split that the UN had envisioned. And that included West Jerusalem.
Right.
They were held from taking all of Jerusalem, mostly by the Jordanian troops, the Arab Legion, that were actually ironically led by the British.
Okay. So this is all before 1967.
Right. Which is why, though, no country has moved their embassy to even West Jerusalem.
Okay.
Because the international community basically accepts that until there's a peace agreement that redefines the status of the city, the original standing of it being an international city remains. Mm-hmm. So nobody's actually moving their embassy even to West Jerusalem,
right?
Even though Israel's been there from 1948.
Okay. Now, that said, there was that conflict, the pre-1967 conflict, was ended with an armistice. Is that right?
Yes.
So there is that degree of whatever an armistice confers on borders. There is that degree of, I don't know, I want to say confirmation. But anyway, the borders are recognized as the line that divides West Jerusalem and East Jerusalem has the status of having been part of an armistice agreement.
Correct.
Prior to 1967.
Correct.
Then with the 1967 war, Jerusalem, Israel, took over the West Bank.
Including Jerusalem, including the Sinai, including the Golan Heights. I mean, Israel, in 1967, Israel more than doubled its entire landmass. It took over the Sinai Peninsula, it took over the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, it took over the Golan Heights. Right. And so all of that then came under Israeli control. But as far as the international community was concerned, it was all occupation. It was all under Israeli occupation,
right,
including East Jerusalem.
So that's the distinction maybe I was getting at, is those, you know, the occupied territory, that does not have the status that is conferred by an armistice. So it is still considered occupied territory by and large by the international community. And, you know, the transfer of, I think it's the Geneva Convention that forbids the transfer of civilian populations to occupied territory.
Right. That's a war crime.
Which is why the settlements are most observers would say, under international law, are a problem because that includes the parts of East Jerusalem that have now been populated by the transfer of Jewish, I guess you would call them settlers, even in the case of East Jerusalem.
Right.
And that's a growing part of East Jerusalem. More and more little pockets of Jewish residents have sprung up.
Well, it's actually more the opposite now. I mean, at this point, it's pockets of Arab. It's pockets of Arabs that are left and that are confined into increasingly smaller neighborhoods, smaller and smaller neighborhoods.
Now, is it really the case that more than 50% of, I mean, leave aside the old city, which is part of East Jerusalem, that was beyond
right.
the armistice borders. So all
right.
the, you know, the within the part that's within the walls, those old walls, is also part of East Jerusalem. But leaving that aside, is the rest of East Jerusalem now more than 50% Jewish?
I don't know the answer about
exactly. But you're saying it's closer than you'd think. There's the
I'm not sure. I don't remember now the existing count. Israel has been concentrating on a policy of depopulating Jerusalem of its Palestinian inhabitants, both Muslim and Christian, in order to make sure that not only is there a Jewish majority, but there's an overwhelming Jewish majority and a Jewish presence in the city. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, if you're a Palestinian and you have a Jerusalem ID card that allows you to live in Jerusalem because you were there before 1967, if you ever leave, if you come to the United States for a year or whatever, you could potentially lose that residency and you can't go back to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have nothing. You know, there's no Palestinian passport. There's no Palestinian ID. And so Israel's basically created a system of tiered citizenship and tiered rights. So if you're a Palestinian who lives inside Israel proper, the borders before 1967,
right.
you were granted citizenship. But if you're a Druze Palestinian, you're allowed to participate in the army. If you're a Bedouin Palestinian, you can participate in the army. But if you're a Christian or a Muslim, you can't.
You actually cannot. It's not that you're allowed not to.
Right. You can't serve in the unless you're a Bedouin or a Druze. I mean, a Bedouin could be a Muslim, could be a Muslim Palestinian. But what they've done is they set up a system of they've divided up the community and tried to set up a system of tiered rights where each community has its own place and it has its own right. It's almost a weird way. It's almost a kind of resemblance of the Dhimmi system that the Ottomans used to have. When they were occupying the entire area, except in this case, the Palestinians, for example, who are in Jerusalem, have less rights. They don't have full citizenship.
You mean
like the Palestinians
East Jerusalem.
In East Jerusalem, right? They don't have full citizenship, but they have a Jerusalem residency. And if you're a Palestinian in the West Bank, of course, then you have no political rights whatsoever. And you have so it's an untenable system. Palestinians have to live in it, and they try to figure out how to survive it and how to get around in it. But it's the ultimate conclusion of it, you know, is designed to be what Donald Trump actually announced. The whole purpose of that kind of a strategy is that one day for Israel to be able to have the international community recognize that Jerusalem, within the borders that Israel has created for Jerusalem, is Israel's capital.
Right. And so to include East Jerusalem, Israel didn't, I think, as a legal matter, quite annex East Jerusalem, but it did kind of redraw the municipal bounds to include East Jerusalem. And interestingly, when the UN Security Council basically rejected that move, the UN under, I guess, President Carter, the U.S. under President Carter abstained rather than veto that resolution, as the U.S. normally does when there's a resolution critical of Israel. So even America's the stance of the UN Security Council is that East Jerusalem is emphatically not part of Israel.
As a matter of fact, the Americans have a consulate. They have two consulates in East Jerusalem, one of them effectively acts as a consulate for the Palestinians. But even the main one is the one that's actually involved with most of the West Bank interactions and dealings. And the embassy in Tel Aviv is the one that deals with Israeli citizens and works on. So there's been a de facto up until Trump. We don't know yet what the legal ramifications for the United States will be from Trump's decision. The State Department seems to be completely confused when they're asked explicitly, what does this mean? Are you changing flags? Are you going to start changing letterhead? Are you going to put new, for example, are you going to start saying Jerusalem, Israel instead of just Jerusalem? What are you going to start doing? And they haven't had answers to any of those questions yet, because I don't think that they were ready for it.
Okay. So, and then the other thing we should say, I guess, is that once this idea of a two-state solution gained currency many, many, many years ago now, the kind of idea was that East Jerusalem would eventually be the capital of a Palestinian state. And this is maybe the most talked about kind of diplomatic casualty, in a way, of Trump's announcement, is people are reading that it as meaning that, you know, realistically, there's never going to be an East Jerusalem that's capital of a Palestinian state. Now, Trump, during his announcement, he did not say, didn't use the word unified or united to refer to Jerusalem, and he did say something vague about how, not, you know, he wasn't prejudging the final, you know, the borders of Israeli sovereignty within Jerusalem that might be part of something or other. He didn't rule out a two-state solution as explicitly as such an announcement might have, and he seemed to want to leave a little wiggle room. But anyway, this is being taken, and in a way, that's what matters as much as anything. It's being taken by many people, including a lot of Palestinians, as being the final nail in the coffin of a two-state solution, right?
Yasser Arafat used to say that he was willing to make compromises on almost everything, but he couldn't make compromises on Jerusalem. And in fact, you know, we know from the Palestinian negotiations and from everything that's been written about it ever since it started in 1992, that the Palestinian leadership under the PLO made a number of concessions early in the process on refugees, on rights of return, on how much security they would control, on elements of basic sovereignty even. But on Jerusalem, they couldn't accept and constantly rejected the idea that, for example, the suburb called Abu Dis, an idea that was floated from way back even in the Clinton time, could become, you know, that somehow that could be called Jerusalem for the Palestinians. That could be called Al-Quds, the Palestinian name for the city. That could be called Al-Quds, and then the Palestinians would be happy. And I think part of the problem is that early in the process, the Israelis began to believe that the Palestinian emphasis on symbolism was in fact their ultimate goal. That if the Palestinians had symbolic sovereignty, if the Palestinians had metaphorical sovereignty, if the PLO could pretend to be a state, as long as it didn't have any of the actual attributes of a state, they would be fine with it. Mm-hmm. And what they didn't recognize, I think, and we're getting to the point now where it's just obvious to everyone, is that there were limits to that symbolism. I mean, the Palestinians could imagine symbolism only as a matter of time until they actually got the real thing. But the idea of living with that symbolism and then pretending that that symbolism had somehow turned into reality, that was something that the Palestinians, you know, there's no Palestinian leadership that exists currently that would be able to accept a partition plan that effectively only left Palestinians with control of, you know, six major cities in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is that if you look at the map of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, it's been just a steady expansion to the point where there would be, well, depending on which settlements were and were not evacuated as part of a settlement, but Israel long ago quit acting as if all of them would be evacuated. And wouldn't be all that kind of coherent and continuous a landmass that was allotted to Palestine under most scenarios.
I think for a lot of your listeners, they may not even recognize, if you haven't been there, you wouldn't see it. When you think of settlements, you probably think of, you know, a bunch of outposts or, you know, some trailers in the desert, etc. No, we're talking about cities, major metropolitan cities that have been built inside the West Bank. Maale Adumim, which is a settlement outside of Jerusalem, actually goes from Jerusalem, its municipal boundaries, all the way almost to the Jordan River. It effectively cuts the West Bank in half.
Well, and what are the deal? And these settlements, the main ones, I gather, I mean, they're connected by roads, right? And what is the status of the roads as far as Palestinians? I mean, Palestinians
can't use them, no.
They can't use the roads. So
no,
the whole
Jewish
West Bank
only roads.
Is kind of sliced and diced up with these roads that Palestinians are not allowed to set foot on.
Right. So you have the wall, you have fences, and you have roads, and you have checkpoints. And effectively, what they all do is make sure that the Palestinians remain confined into their urban areas, into tight confined areas, and the Israeli Jewish population that's been imported into the West Bank effectively is integrated into Israel. So you could go from an Israeli city in the West Bank to Tel Aviv in a matter of, you know, half an hour without any issue, without any problem, without going through checkpoints, without any problems. But if you're a Palestinian, you can't even get out of one city to get to another Palestinian city.
Right. So, you wrote a piece that we'll link to that was very interesting, and it laid out where you think the Palestinians should go from here in light of the fact that the two-state solution seems to be almost officially dead now, at least as it's been conceived. And, you know, you start out the piece with a really interesting kind of vignette that I guess I hadn't read enough to be aware of. But it has to do with a kind of a final offer, I guess, that was made to Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, right? By this young and I guess it's safe to say not very risk averse crown prince, Mohammed bin. How does he pronounce the last? It's bin
Salman.
Salman. You know, he's been in the headlines for a number of things. He essentially tried to kidnap. Well, we won't get into all this stuff, but he's had a number of initiatives that haven't gone very well with respect to Lebanon, with respect to Yemen, so now he goes to Abbas and he lays down some deal that he expects Abbas to accept, right? Or he hopes Abbas will accept.
The New York Times, the way the New York Times reported it, was that at the same time that he had summoned the Lebanese prime minister to Saudi Arabia.
That's what I was referring to.
Exactly. And then that led to the forced resignation. Then Abbas was also summoned. And that wasn't reported on as much. But Abbas traveled there and, according to the New York Times, was told that in a few months, President Trump would present a peace plan to the Palestinians and the Israelis, and that Abbas should be prepared to accept that plan. And if he wasn't going to accept it, he should be prepared to step down so that another Palestinian could be put in his place that could accept it. And Abbas wanted to know, well, okay, what's the plan? You know, we've all been waiting to hear what the plan is. What's the plan? And as the plan was described to him, Jerusalem wasn't included. It effectively would give the Palestinians the towns that they were already in administering in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and the Israelis would maintain control of the rest of the West Bank, would maintain control of the territory borders. There would be no right of return for refugees, but the Palestinians might get statehood. The thing that they get on those cities that they have now might be called a state. And in return, Saudi Arabia would contribute financially to the well-being of those enclaves in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank that the Palestinians were living in. And so when...
So basically, it was Saudi Arabia saying, we will give you a bunch of money to settle for way less than has been assumed the Palestinians would get as part
right.
of a two-state deal.
Right.
No Jerusalem, no East Jerusalem. And I mean, we should add that all along, I think the U.S. and Israel have assumed that the Palestinians were going to accept fairly little in terms of some of the traditional accoutrements of statehood, like actual control of your borders. Palestinians have never really signed on to that idea. But anyway, that was part of it, too. So it was like a patchwork quasi-state almost that doesn't have all the attributes of statehood and does not have East Jerusalem as its capital. And they were going to get a bunch of money.
And as Netanyahu refers to it, you know, statehood, he said the Palestinians can get statehood if they accept statehood without sovereignty. Now, that would be a brand new definition, of course, for statehood, because it's a fundamental attribute of statehood that you have sovereignty. And so as soon as Abbas left Saudi Arabia and went back to Jordan, the first thing he did was call King Abdullah and then everybody else, including, I guess, French President Macron, including Fatah leaders, and to complain and to describe the plan and say, well, what are we going to do? You know, I can't accept this. What are we going to do? And then shortly after that, just weeks after that, right, you get the Trump statement on Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, in effect, it's all wrapped together. I mean, the world, I can't remember, and I can't remember a situation where the United States took a policy position and within 24 hours was unanimously condemned by virtually every ally, not just every country in the world, but every ally, and in which the Security Council has to meet the next day or within 2 days in order to actually have major countries of the world all reject the statement by the United States. And that UN Security Council meeting, two of the members who called for it were France and Britain. Mm-hmm. So I don't know when that's happened before, but it is, I think, indicative of how shocked and how concerned everyone was that, in fact, the Jared Trump-Salman peace plan that might be presented in a few months would actually be simply a codification of the existing occupation.
Yeah. And the term Jared is interesting here. I mean, he had this reportedly long into the wee hours of the morning meeting with the Crown Prince sometime before the Crown Prince presented this plan to the Palestinians, right?
And just before he rounded up all of the princes and business leaders and media leaders in Saudi Arabia
right.
at the Ritz.
And so, but I mean, it could be that this whole thing, not just the Palestinian plan that he mistakenly thought Abbas could live with, but these various initiatives, you know, quasi-kidnapping the prime minister of Lebanon and then rounding up all these, you know, we don't know how much of this he actually discussed with Jared Kushner, but it seems to me, it's hard for me to imagine that the Israel-Palestine thing he had not talked to Kushner about, right?
Well, I believe that the United States said that the purpose of that meeting was to discuss the peace plan, not to discuss internal Saudi policy or internal Saudi machinations, but to discuss or not to discuss Yemen, but to actually discuss the peace plan.
So there we are. And you in your piece. So naturally, the plan was rejected. It's almost strange that would surprise Kushner or the Crown Prince or anyone. But I guess maybe it did. But anyway, their plan was rejected. And now the question is, what do the Palestinians do? And you have kind of a three-part, I don't know if you'd call it a plan, but three kind of principles that you think the Palestinians should pursue. Is that a fair way to put it?
I mean, you know, any advice is cheap. I think the challenge for, you know, I've worked with the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank is the same one that I worked with when I was a legal advisor. I mean, it hasn't changed. And the challenge that they've all had, they're all nationalists. I mean, they all seek Palestinian freedom, but, you know, they may hate each other at times, and they may be fighting with each other over who should be the leader and who should run things and whose policy is best. But they all want the same thing at the end of the day, which is an independent Palestine. But when I think what people in the United States fail to realize is that when Palestinians in 1988 accepted a partition plan, you know, they accepted the partition plan, as the Israelis would say, too late. You accepted it in 1988 and you should have accepted it in 1948. But when they accepted it in 1988 and said, okay, we'll accept a state on 22% of historic Palestine, that was the big lift for them. They thought that that was the big lift for them. They thought, okay, this is it. I am making a historical compromise now. Mm-hmm. I am accepting 22% instead of asking for a secular democratic state in all of Palestine, which was the PLO's demand from 1965 until 1988. And so when they switched from that kind of anti-apartheid model to a kind of almost Inkatha Freedom Party, you know, they switched from ANC to Inkatha Freedom Party. They switched from demanding equality and egalitarianism in one state to a partition that would allow them to have an ethnic state. And
by one state, you mean all of what is now Israel and the occupied territory.
Right.
So they switch from a strategy of saying we just want to have full and equal rights and be able to vote and everything in this whole entire expanse of what was formerly called Palestine, before Israel was created, to saying, well, okay, we will settle for our own. We'll have two more or less ethnically defined states, Israel and Palestine.
And when they accepted that, they didn't do that because they thought this was some great moral success. I mean, it was almost seen as a failure. It was seen as a fundamental compromise of Palestinian national aspirations and goals. But it was felt that this was the only thing possible. They did not think that they were ever going to achieve equality. And so they thought this was the only thing that we could get, that the Israelis would accept to have us live side by side with them on a much smaller piece of territory.
Right.
And the whole process has been predicated on that assumption. And now you can't find Palestinians, including in the leadership, I believe, you can't find Palestinians who actually believe that that goal is obtainable.
Right.
And so if that goal is not obtainable, and the first goal wasn't obtainable, then I think the Israelis are still talking about the Jordan option. The Israelis are still talking about
transferring the Palestinians to Jordan.
Yes, having Jordan become a Palestinian state.
Moving them all across the river, expelling them all.
Well, some Israel. I mean, let's be fair. Some Israelis are still talking about that, but the more common theme that you hear is to make life so uncomfortable for Palestinians in the West Bank that they ultimately, enough of them move out that the ones that are left behind no longer form a demographic, quote unquote, demographic threat to Israel's Jewish majority.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. So the Palestinians now have like an existential, this is an existential moment for the Palestinians. Like, where do they go from here? In 1988, they decided that they had to go to the two-state approach. Right now, they've been told concretely, in no uncertain terms, by the Israelis, we're never going to give you independence. We're never going to give you sovereignty in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. We're never going to give you East Jerusalem, the most sacred and sacrosanct part of what you're seeking. We're not going to give you that. And we're certainly not going to give you any right of return for refugees. And at a time when countries in the Middle East are facing the existential challenge of whether they're going to be ethnic states or citizen states. How is Iraq going to survive as a unitary state, as an ethnic state? It can't. It can only survive as
a citizen state. How is what going to survive?
Iraq. Iraq can only survive as a citizen state, right? It's got Kurds, it's got Sunnis, it's got Shias, Yazidis, it's got Turkmens, it's got a whole host of ethnic groups and nationalities, etc. If it's going to be an ethnic Arab state, then the other groups are going to want out. Mm-hmm. If it's going to be a Shia state, the Sunnis are going to want out. So the only way it succeeds is if it has a secular state, let's say a citizen state, since the word secular is confusing in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to be a citizen state that forms its identity around its borders, not around the ethnicity of the people that are in it. The same challenge is facing Israel and the Palestinians right now.
Okay, so, I mean, and we should say that, you know, when we were talking about these two scenarios, one in which the entire expanse of what is now Israel plus the occupied territory is, you know, occupied by both groups, and the Palestinians are granted full rights and political rights and so on, that being a kind of a one-state solution, you know, we should say the Israelis would describe that in less benign terms. I mean, many of them would, it's an assumption of theirs that that's not a stable situation, that a majority Palestinian population, and this is also what they say if you ask, you know, you mentioned right of return, the right of all refugees and descendants of refugees, I guess, to return to where they were before all this, including Israel proper. The Israelis would say the same thing about that, which is what they would say about both of these, I think, is, look, if we, you know, permit a majority Palestinian population to be part of this larger citizen state, we will eventually, I mean, different Israelis would say different things. Some would say the Jews will eventually be driven out. You know, we won't even be allowed to stay. Others would say, well, it'll be the end of a Jewish state, and who knows what our status will be, might not be good, and so on. So many Israelis find that profoundly threatening, right?
Well, there's certainly not an acceptance among the majority of Israelis for it today. It was a discussion when Israel was being created. When Israel was being created, there were different Jewish tendencies and movements in Zionism, and they were trying to decide what kind of state Israel was going to be. Mm-hmm. And should Israel be an ethnically Jewish state, or should Israel be a democratic state with equal rights for the Arab population that already existed there? And so the one trend obviously won out over the other. But I think that this conversation has been muted by the fact that the Palestinians since 1988 haven't made an official discussion or issue of it, because it's not really also just a black and white, it's on a spectrum, right? There's all forms of consociational arrangements mm-hmm. that, you know, countries have developed, Belgium, Quebec, and Canada, even Bosnia, which is probably the least positive form of confederation. But even that one, for example, still allows freedom of movement to all of its citizens across the entire territory, and equal rights, at least on paper, to all of its citizens. And so the question has been dealt with before. It's not as if the Palestinians and the Israelis are the first two peoples to ever have two ethnic groups squabble over a piece of territory. The question is how do the Palestinians now drive that conversation? Mm-hmm. Now that Donald Trump has told them, now that perhaps Crown Prince Salman has told them, that the only solution for them, if under the current model, the only solution for them is to accept what they have now and say thank you, treat that like liberty, and move on, so that the rest of the world can stop thinking about this conflict and everybody can just move on. Well, that's not an option open to the Palestinians. They can't accept the current situation and call it freedom. There's just no Palestinian alive that can be able to sell that to anybody.
Yeah. So you lay out kind of three things in this piece of yours, and it starts, I think, if I remember correctly, with like what should the relationship be? I mean, one thing maybe people don't understand is that right now, kind of, the United States and Israel are together have a tremendous amount of leverage over Palestinians, well, for more than one reason. But one of the reasons is that a huge amount of the money that goes into Palestine in the form of salaries and so on comes ultimately from, like, I don't know what, the United States or whoever. But the point is, it depends on the continued support of the United States and Israel, right? Yeah. I mean, if you look at, like, where do the salaries of the the people in the Palestinian Authority come from? And
So it comes from the European Union and the Arab world.
Oh, it does.
And the United States has been contributing heavily to the Palestinian security services.
Okay.
Because the Palestinian police's job is not to actually provide security for Palestinians. Their job is to prevent Palestinians from attacking Israelis. And so the United States obviously has a vested interest in helping Israel protect itself. And so it supports the training and the funding of Palestinian security services.
Okay,
but I think Congress is trying to stop that.
So the government gets its money kind of from Europe, broadly speaking, and the security services, which keep things under control from Israel's point of view, from getting out of hand, get their money kind of from the United States.
And yes, and training, and you know, and their guns are through the Israeli. I mean, the Israelis, the weapons come through that system. They're tagged, and you know, everybody knows which, you know, even where that weapon. They can trace each and every single gun and each and every single weapon. So the challenge is that the PLO has placed itself in a position where it's now entirely dependent financially on these systems, right? The Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip get their salaries effectively through the Palestinian Authority. If the Palestinians decided to say, okay, this whole thing with the two-state thing has been a sham, we're going to have to figure out something different, we're going to move in a different direction, they've actually tied themselves through agreements, through the Oslo Accords, through the Paris Accords. So there are all kinds of individual agreements between the Israelis and the PLO that they've signed, between Europeans and the PLO that they've signed, that effectively have tied the PLO into acting as an administrator for the occupation. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying that as a first step, the PLO needs to meet with itself and with economists and with security experts, etc., not to figure out a peace agreement with Israel, but to figure out how to divest itself from playing this role as Israel's administrator.
Okay, so just a little footnote here. So the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, maybe we should clarify the relationship between that and the Palestinian Authority. I gather the PLO is the legal representative of the Palestinian people, including, I gather, displaced people who don't live in the occupied territory but were displaced during the establishment of Israel and the subsequent conflict. Is that right?
As far as the Arab League and the United Nations are concerned, the PLO is the legal representative of the Palestinian people.
And then the Palestinian Authority was established later and is kind of the government, the administrator of the West Bank. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
And so the Palestinian Authority doesn't have that sovereign representative capacity. But for all practical purposes, the PLO subsumed itself into the PA. Like, the PLO doesn't exist except on paper. It still has legal personality, but for all practical purposes, all of the PLO efforts, all of the PLO budget, everything went into the Palestinian Authority. Mm-hmm. And so, because the assumption was that by 1999, the Palestinians were going to have a state. The idea was that, you know, there was going to be a peace agreement. There was going to be a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip with East Jerusalem as its capital. And the PLO, you know, could transform itself into, you know, becoming a ruling party instead of a liberation movement. And so they made that transition before they actually obtained independence.
Okay.
So you have to divest yourself. Now you have to figure out, I mean, right now, President Abbas cannot leave Ramallah without an Israeli general approving his transfer.
He can't go from one town in the West Bank to another.
Right.
Without approval.
Correct.
And you're saying that the Palestinian leadership, PLO/PA, has to somehow reduce the amount of its dependence its political dependence on, for example, the United States? Is that the idea, which would include somehow weaning itself financially off of certain forms of financial support, or what? Flesh out what should be done.
Well, I think the problem with the PLO was often, you know, it had a revolutionary chic, you know, in this 1960s and the 1970s and even into the early 1980s, maybe not in the United States, but, you know, in Europe and in the global South.
Right.
And it was in many ways one of the best funded revolutions. It operated with a lot of largesse. It had a lot of money that was coming into it from a variety of sources. And Yasser Arafat's genius was probably his ability to balance all of that money coming in from all these variety of sources that all basically want some piece of the pie. They want some piece of control over the PLO. But he managed to take that money in and maintain some modicum of independent decision making for the Palestinians. And when that all sort of came to a crashing halt with the Iraq War, the first U.S.-Iraq War. The Persian Gulf War, when that iconic moment when he went to visit Saddam Hussein and they greeted each other, and that greeting became a picture thing that went around, you know, sort of went around the world, and it pissed off a lot of the Gulf states that were funding the PLO, and they stopped at that moment funding the PLO. And when the PLO wasn't getting money, and a lot of the Palestinians who were in Kuwait were ultimately evicted from Kuwait after the liberation of Kuwait because they were deemed to be sympathetic to the Iraqis. That forced the Palestinians to seek a different pot of money. And the pot of money that they ended up seeking ultimately became the European Union, the United States, and the Arab League, Arab countries, giving them money in exchange for this Oslo process. Now they've got to figure out a way of actually having a true revolutionary movement that's not confined to the dictates of foreign governments.
So they need to, you're saying they need to get off the dole not only of the Arab states, but also Europe and of course the U.S.
Well, no.
To the extent that that's a factor? Or
I'm saying that the Palestinian civil society that exists inside the West Bank and the Gaza Strip still needs to eat.
Right.
They still need to receive their salaries. The people who are cleaning the roads, the people that are running municipalities, the people that are doctors, the teachers, they all still need to get their salaries. So if the European Union is funding those salaries, that's great. But does the PA need to be a middleman? What does the Palestinian Authority, or what does the PLO get? Or maybe the PLO can recreate itself outside of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and leave the Palestinian Authority as a kind of middleman to simply handle the transfer of payments. But the PLO itself, my argument is that the PLO itself needs to move back into a revolutionary mindset. It needs to move back into the mindset of, you know, we're nowhere near having freedom. We are nowhere near having independence. And so what are our goals? We can't even discuss our goals anymore outside of this Oslo framework.
So before we flesh out what you mean by revolutionary movement, you're saying it needs to just have enough freedom to speak its mind, and that means not being dependent on its current sources of financial support?
It needs to divorce its decision-making capacity from the money. It needs the money. The money needs to still come in, but it needs to, just like it has in the past, been able to say, thank you very much for the money, but this is what we are demanding. Not thank you very much for the money. What is it that you need us to say?
Okay, let's jump ahead to the demand, which I think is the kind of the third thing you lay out in your piece. But and it's not like I think you have a real specific kind of recipe, but. Broadly speaking, I gather you're talking about moving back in the direction of this idea of demanding political rights within, you know, no more two-state solution. Say, look, we are part of this broad expanse, all of which is ruled by Israel. Ultimately, the West Bank, Israel proper, call it what you will. It's all ruled by Israel. We're living here, being ruled by Israel. We want full political rights that citizens generally get. Is that broadly speaking what you're advocating?
Personally, I prefer citizen state models. I live in the United States. I'm an American. I like the theoretical construct of equality and egalitarianism for everybody. Mm-hmm. But my argument for the Palestinians is that they actually need to have that conversation as to what is it that we want. Do we want to go back to what we were arguing for before 1988? Do we want to argue it in a different way? Do we want to argue for some kind of binationalism? Do we want to argue for consociationalism? Do we want to argue for full South Africa-style equality? What is it that we want? Mm-hmm. But that conversation now needs to take place in a global square. It needs to take place with Palestinians everywhere, not just the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but it needs to take place with the 20% of Israel's population that are Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship.
Okay.
And who are in the Israeli Knesset, and who are perhaps the most politically sophisticated Palestinians in the world. They speak English, they speak Hebrew, they speak Arabic. They are fluent with working with Israelis and with working within a Zionist structure, but demanding civil rights. They're familiar with global civil rights movements. They're far advanced in many ways than the Palestinians that are elsewhere. And so now there needs to be a global conversation among Palestinians inside Israel, Palestinians in the occupied territory, and Palestinians in the diaspora. And the PLO can lead that conversation, but it needs to be a conversation that they have that very quickly comes to what I would like to be a freedom charter, similar to the South African Freedom Charter, that would define a set of overriding principles that the Palestinians everywhere, you don't have to belong to the PLO, you don't have to belong to Hamas or Fatah or any political party, but everybody subscribes to.
What's an example of a principle that might be on that part of that charter?
Oh, it could be equality, that regardless of the solution that we come up with, there would have to be freedom of movement and equality for all people who live in Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. The irony is that the holiest part of historic Palestine or greater Israel, whichever one you want, the holiest part for Jews is actually the West Bank. It's Judea and Samaria. It's not Tel Aviv. And the holiest part for Palestinians when they think of Palestine in their mind, the most iconic cities are the coastal cities, Haifa, Yaffa, Akka, the cities along the coast that define Palestine, the olive orchards, the history of Palestine as a port city. As a country of ports, that's the iconic part for Palestinians. So the iconic parts for both Jews, one of the reasons the two-state thing hasn't really worked out is that the iconic part for Jews and the iconic part for Palestinians happen to be on each other's territory.
Yeah, that is a problem.
But if you have freedom of movement, you know, I had Palestinians when I first started as a legal advisor. Palestinians were still supportive of the Oslo process. They were still happy to hear that we were trying to negotiate a two-state deal. And that was at the beginning in 2000 when I got there. But a few years later, when the situation was so disastrous and nobody could move and there were tanks everywhere and you couldn't get out of one city to another, Palestinians were telling me, you know, before the PLO came, we could go anywhere. I mean, we had no political rights, but I could get in my car and drive to Tel Aviv on the weekend and go to the beach. I had no political rights. I couldn't vote. And but if I had a car accident and my car hit an Israeli Jewish car, because Palestinians in the West Bank had different license tags, if my car hit their car, the Israeli national insurance carrier would still provide for my medical bills or to repair my car. So before the Oslo process, Palestinians lived with freedom of movement, but with no political rights. And then after the Oslo process, they still didn't gain political rights, but they also lost freedom of movement. One of the overarching principles would have to be freedom of movement for Jews and Palestinians, regardless of their religion, regardless of their ethnicity, freedom of movement to interact throughout the entire territory.
Mm-hmm. So let me mention an initiative I've suggested to some Palestinians. I mean, it's been a while now. You know, I was on the visited the West Bank in, I guess, 2011 and mentioned it to a couple then. And I'm sure you've heard this. But what I said at the time was, you know, if you said, look, okay, the two-state solution is not going to happen. All we want is political rights. And you started having, like, large, totally peaceful demonstrations just demanding the right to vote in Israeli elections. I said, look, I think you would be able to get a lot a very visible international support. And I said, and in fact, ironically, this might lead to a two-state solution because it would so terrify the Israelis that they might come up with a much more accommodating position in the two-state context, because few things scare them more than all the Palestinians being given the vote. Because again, they imagine that if Palestinians wouldn't constitute a majority immediately, they eventually would, and that's the end of the Jewish state, possibly the end of various other things, and so on. Now, what I was told generally was, you know, that's just not really part of the conversation for a number of reasons, one of which is that to say that we want to vote in Israeli elections is to normalize the occupation. It's to accept the validity of the Israeli occupation. So that was like considered a non-starter back then. Now, do you think that leaving aside the question of what it would lead to and whether it might conceivably, ironically, lead to a two-state solution, do you think that even after Trump's announcement, that kind of thing remains a non-starter for Palestinians?
I think Palestinians right now they don't know how to get from here to there. They don't know how to get from asking for two states, and you know, international law clearly stipulates that the West Bank and Gaza are occupied territory, and they don't want to change that. They don't want, like you say, to normalize and say we accept that Israel has control over this. There are ways, of course, of doing that. I mean, you don't have to actually simply say, well, we want equality. You can say, well, we want a Palestinian state, but we want that Palestinian state to be integrated with Israel. We want it to be a binational state. Mm-hmm. We want Israel to end the occupation, but we want to imagine a political entity that has one currency and that has a freedom of movement for all peoples and residency rights for all people all across the entire territory. I mean, you could be right now in the European Union. For the countries that are in the European Union, not those that are trying to pull out, but those that are in it, you can go from one country to another country. You can live in that country. You can buy property in that country. You can live in that country. You can go to school in that country. You can get all the benefits of that country and still be a citizen of your country and go back to your country to vote, or vote even from that other country for your country's national elections. Mm-hmm. I mean, other people have figured it out. Other people have figured out how you can do this. And so it's not an either or. I think Ehud Olmert made the same argument, I think, in an interview with Thomas Friedman in The New Yorker when he was prime minister, where he said we have to get a two-state solution because we need to prevent the Palestinians from moving to an anti-apartheid type of struggle. And he said the frightening thing of them moving to that kind of a struggle, to paraphrase him, is not that they would automatically succeed. It's because that would destroy the Jewish state, but in his words, but it is because we would lose the American Jewish community. How could the American Jewish community support us when we're in the role of the white government of South Africa preventing equality? Right. And once we lose the American Jewish community, it's over for us. And so his argument was we needed to get to two states in order to prevent that eventuality from happening. Right now, the Likud government's position is, well, no, we won't get to two states, but we want to prevent that eventuality from happening also. And if you're on the Palestinian side of it, you've got to figure, well, the status quo is untenable. We can't stay where we are. So the question is, how are we going to move forward?
Mm-hmm. So you're, Well, you're mainly advocating the beginning of a whole new conversation.
Yes.
Among Palestinians, including Palestinians in Israel proper. And you want to facilitate that conversation by kind of changing, again, maybe you should help me, but changing the nature of the dependence of the of Palestinian leaders on various other parties. Is that right?
I mean, they should ultimately, it'd be preferable if the PLO was dependent on Palestinians.
The problem is that we call them the leaders of the Palestinians, but in fact, those aren't their masters.
If your pay is coming from somewhere else,
right,
then that obviously has an influence. And if it's one thing if that money is coming because, you know, we support your cause, you've defined your cause, and that money is coming to support your cause. It's another if the money is being used to define your cause. And this is, I think, you know, for the Palestinians, this is, you know, and this is where Abbas, if in fact the New York Times reporting is accurate, and I suspect it is, because even Bloomberg has been reporting that Tillerson has been terrified at the potential of a peace plan that he hasn't seen that sounds pretty bad, that Jared and Trump might present ultimately in a couple of months, that would, you know, destroy chances for any progress whatsoever. And so I think the State Department is right. If the State Department seems to be almost as afraid as Abu Mazen of the kind of an agreement or the kind of deal that Crown Prince Salman allegedly described to Abbas. So I think we can be confident that that's at least the parameters of the conversation that the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia are now having about how to justify normalizing Saudi-Israeli relations. And so the Palestinians, I think, are a footnote in it. It's just, mm-hmm. what do we need the Palestinians to do in order to help us get mm-hmm. to the other goal that we're at? The Palestinians now need to say, okay, and they were, again, trying to buy it, right? They told Abbas, you know, part of the deal will be that we will make the cities as comfortable as possible. There will be a flood of money into all of the Palestinian cities in order to keep everybody quiet for a while, in order to keep everybody happy. But there isn't a Palestinian who could, I mean, we've reached the limits. We've reached the limits of patronage, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. The patronage system now doesn't work. It's asking Palestinians to do what they can't do.
Well, I mean, even as it is, the patronage undermines Abbas's actual, well, the respect that he commands among the Palestinian people, right?
I mean, there's a crisis of legitimacy among the entire Palestinian leadership.
Right.
I mean,
because they are thought of as having these paymasters who are not Palestinians,
and because no progress has been made.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've been promised for all these years. There haven't been elections.
Right? I mean, you said that part of the problem is that the Palestinians aren't the true masters of the so-called leaders. So elections would that be a good thing?
Well, elections would be a good thing if you could have elections in a free environment. But certainly introducing a conversation that includes all aspects of Palestinian civil society around the world, mm-hmm. which the PLO used to do. I mean, the PLO used to be very heavily involved with the Palestinian diaspora community. They would support trade unions. They would support school groups. They would support unions. They would send speakers. They considered it part of their network, mm-hmm. to have this global. If you had an NGO, if you were a human rights organization, for the PLO, this used to be part of its entire web. And when it moved into the West Bank, it gave it all up. And it shut it all down.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have authentic civil society groups that are independent, completely and totally independent of the PLO, completely and totally independent of the Palestinian Authority, that exist everywhere. And you have the third largest bloc in the Israeli Knesset is composed of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, the joint list.
Mm-hmm.
And so you actually have authentic representational groups of Palestinians all across the world. So I think the first step is simply to get those people together and begin to have a conversation with those groups to come up to a joint goal, a joint strategy. And if the strategy is ultimately egalitarian, if it is equality, then that defines your tactics. Because if you're having a national liberation struggle, violence you can understand why violence would be part of a national liberation struggle, because you're attempting to liberate territory from a foreign army, right? You're trying to get a foreign army out of your territory. If the goal is egalitarian, if the goal is peaceful coexistence across the entire territory, that requires an entirely different set of resistance, right? It requires a lot of nonviolent civil disobedience. It requires boycotts and divestment and sanctions. It requires interaction between Jews and Palestinians working together instead of against each other, but working together on common goals. If the goal is to live in some form of egalitarianism. And so you can get to the tactics. I mean, I think if you come up with the right goals, the tactics that come out of it actually are also more positive than the ones that have been used in the past.
Okay. Now, I assume you concede that if you could arrange for this less constrained conversation to take place and you could get some kind of consensus on how to proceed, any of the paths you might take that don't aim at a two-state solution, which presumably is dead, any of those paths are going to be found by most Israelis quite threatening. So it's going to be kind of a long haul getting them on board for whatever happens, right? I mean, as you said, there's a whole lot of possible configurations that could result from such a conversation. It could be a confederation of two different states. It could be a lot of things. But it seems to me there are at least three hurdles. One is facilitating the conversation you describe, which, as you said, or at least by your analysis, would take a restructuring of kind of the means of support of the leadership. Then you're going to need to get that conversation to result in some kind of coherent strategy or set of principles. And then you're going to ultimately need to convince enough Israelis so that something happens. So those are like three separate challenges. And I guess if you think I've got it right in terms of these three challenges, I guess you would agree that that's like a long haul. It's a challenge.
No, it is a long haul, and I do think it's a challenge. And I think one of the failures of the Palestinian demands for a secular democratic state between 1965 and 1988 was that they didn't succeed to the extent the ANC did in South Africa in convincing enough Israeli Jews that they had an interest in that kind of an outcome as well. And so, yes, I think that you have to learn from the things that didn't work in the past as well. And so if what you're arguing is I want one man, one vote, or one person, one vote, because I have more babies than you do, mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's not going to fly. I mean, that's just majority oppressing a minority. That won't fly. Nobody's going to accept that. No Palestinian would accept being a minority in that situation, and no Israeli Jew would accept being a minority in that situation. So you can't come up with something that's obviously prejudicial to either party. It's got to actually work, right? It's got to actually be in the benefit of. I mean, you had, for the first time, I think, in the last Israeli election, Gershon Baskin, I think, ran, or either in the last election or the election before that, ran on a platform of consociationalism, of arguing for some form of consociationalism. Now, I don't think it succeeded, and I don't think he got very far.
Now, what did he – I take it he's an Israeli Jew who was running for the Knesset?
Yeah, who's running for the Knesset. Uh-huh. But, the conversation is out there. It's not as if it's impossible. And I think that the number of Israeli Jews who – I've worked – when I was working in the West Bank, I was able to go into Israel a lot. I was able to speak often with Israelis. And certainly I encountered a lot of racism and a lot of bigotry. But I also encountered a lot of people who, loved – the idea, but thought that it was theoretical, thought that there was no way you could make it practical. But if it was possible, if it was practical, that was a different issue. And I think the Palestinians haven't done enough yet to try to make it practical and positive so that's not just positive on the Palestinian side. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not just that Palestinians have something to gain. I mean, I think in the United States, we're still struggling. We're still fighting for equality. We're still struggling for egalitarianism, and we're still having trouble identifying. So if you're maybe a white male, you think that everything is fine and everything is good. But, you know, if you're a black male, maybe not so much. It's not actually working out that way for you. And, you know, being able to get to a place where you have that, where you have an equal society is a long-term, it's a long-term challenge. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that the Palestinians don't have a choice. It's, you know, living under occupation in perpetuity is not something that, you know, having a war every 2 or 3 years or an intifada every 5 or 6. I mean, this is not a way. We're losing generation after generation after generation. We should be, you know, Palestinians and Israelis should be worried about how to fight climate change, what to do about rising seas. They should be worried about, you know, promoting democracy in the Middle East. They should be worried about gender equality. They should be worried about those types of issues and those types of causes. And yet they're still fighting a tribal ethnic battle from the 1800s.
Well, and this is not the only part of the world you could say that about. But no, it's a great tragedy of the common of the historical moment is there's all these issues that need international cooperation or, you know, trans-ethnic, trans-religious, whatever kind of cooperation, more and more of them, and yet more and more the world seems divided by tribalism of one kind or another. Let me ask you, final question is, do you see, in terms of the immediate reaction to the Jerusalem, Trump's move on Jerusalem, any glimmers of hope? I mean, I know one thing that happened is this guy, I guess it's Eric Hutt, or I don't know how you pronounce his name, but he was the lead Palestinian negotiator.
Saab Eric Hutt, yeah.
Yeah, he kind of said, look, the two states dead. He made noises about, now the conversation is about political rights. Right. And so there's that. Are you seeing any other signs that the conversation's moving in the direction you might hope?
I think the conversation among the diaspora, which hasn't been on the news, because they're not doing anything violent, they're not doing anything untoward.
So
but
these
they're
are
having,
people mainly in surrounding Arab countries like Jordan and Lebanon?
Well, in Europe, in the United States,
okay.
First of all, primarily where they're more accustomed to the concept of citizen states and they're more accustomed to the concept of equality, there's been a definite move in that direction. In the West Bank, it's beginning to catch up. I mean, I think the most recent polls are almost 50-50 on you know, supporting some form of egalitarianism as opposed to a West Bank state. And so the thing that I think has been holding things back has been the belief that, well, maybe, just maybe, we're about to get a Palestinian state. Maybe, just maybe, we're about to get freedom in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, at least. And now that it's, you know, been clear, I mean, the Israelis had the opportunity, if they had wanted to, they could have let Gaza become a state. They could have tried to divest that portion of the Palestinian public, and they could have, like, opened them up to the world and allowed them to free. But they still insisted on controlling the entire borders of Gaza. They insisted on not allowing Gazans to leave the strip, having trouble leaving and coming back in. They put pressure on Egypt as to who should leave and who should come back in. The challenge is that when you have power, I mean, it's any system of colonialism. Once you have that power, you're terrified of giving it up because you're afraid, you know, once I give it up, I've treated the natives badly. Mm-hmm. once I stop treating them badly and I'm pulled back, they're going to want to treat me badly. And that's a normal fear for any colonial power. It's a normal concern for any colonial power. But it ends up leading to a self-perpetuating occupation. You can never leave because the things you've done are so heinous that you're afraid that the people that you've done it to will somehow always seek revenge against you. And so you're caught in this perpetual need to oppress.
Yeah, no, you know Daniel Seidman, is it Seidman? Yeah. You know him, I'm
Daniel
sure.
Daniel Seidman,
an Israeli
yeah.
Jew who's very active in Jerusalem affairs.
He's the world's foremost authority on Jerusalem.
And he was I did a dialogue with him in New York and some years ago, and he brought up this this thing that I think Thomas Jefferson said about slavery. It's like having a wolf by the ears. You're afraid to keep holding on and you're afraid to let go. It's like neither seems like a very appealing option.
But we know which is the only morally possible option. And I think it's time now for the Palestinians. I mean, this is my argument was really aimed at Palestinians. So it wasn't really aimed at what the Europeans should do or what the United States should do or what the Arab states should do. It was really aimed at what the Palestinians should do. And my argument is for the Palestinians that it's time to reacquaint themselves with their allies. It's time to actually begin having a conversation amongst themselves about how they can divest themselves of the current situation and what are the goals that they want to seek in the new situation. And I think that right now the Palestinian community worldwide is sophisticated enough that the conclusion to that conversation is going to be something that's very ennobling, very positive, not just for Palestinians, but for Jews in Israel who want to also live, just like everybody else, a normal life free of conflict.
Okay. Well, thank you, Amjad, so much. Now, where can now you're not doing a whole lot of writing now. You're doing mainly this consulting work with NGOs and dealing with various problems, actually, in other parts of the world as well. But is there a place? What's that?
We're having a very similar. I mean, you know, the situation of Rohingya in Burma, the apartheid like conditions. I think Amnesty, I think, has referred to them as apartheid like conditions inside Burma for the Rohingya. The expulsion, the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya into Bangladesh. The demand for them to return home and the trying to figure out how they can return home and under what conditions they can return home. A lot of these are very similar. Very similar issues, very similar, and may end up having similar answers. But the conversation, but the conversation has to, on the Palestinian side, you know, the Rohingya is an entirely different conversation. But on the Palestinian side, it's time for the Palestinians to reacquaint themselves with that global community that used to support them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true that today, Trump can make the statement he made on Jerusalem, and it caused emotional and moral outrage, but it didn't cause the kind of reaction that one would have expected even 15 or 20 years ago. And I think part of that is because the world moved, it didn't leave the Palestinian issue, but decided that since the Palestinians themselves seem to have dropped the issue, that there wasn't a need for them to be invested in it. Mm-hmm. And I think the Palestinians can now reacquaint themselves with that global South movement and the progressives even in the United States. You can't go to a Black Lives Matter demonstration without sometimes seeing a Palestinian flag. Mm-hmm. And that's not being held necessarily by a Palestinian. But the people equating the quest for equality here in the United States mm-hmm. with the quest for equality among Palestinians is a global one.
Right. And that is, we didn't really mention this, but this is also part of your proposal, I think, is establishing, in terms of the connection of Palestinians to the rest of the world, think less exclusively in terms of like connections to governments around the world and more in terms of grassroots support around the world.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you. And what's
Thanks,
your
Bob.
Twitter handle? Where can people follow you?
At Atallah Amjad. At Atallah Amjad.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Meaning of Life TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Meaning of Life episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at meaningoflife.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.